the truth is actually words do inspire. Words do help people get involved. Words do help members.
Welcome, Emily. As the co-president of the International Relations Society, you oversee the communications, academic programming, the annual conference, and the strategic direction of the society. Please begin by telling us more about yourself. Specifically, what inspired you to pursue studying international relations?
Okay, so I'm a student here at Trinity College. I became interested in international relations after my first Model United Nations conference. And I had a really fun time. I met some amazing people, and I decided I wanted to live my life in a moderated caucus. And then I looked for programs with international relations in Canada. I liked economics, history, and political science, and this was the only program in Canada that offers an interdisciplinary place of study. So I came here, and I knew that it was close to Toronto. I'm from Scarborough, and that's why I came here.
Great. Please begin by providing our listeners with relevant information pertaining to the International Relations Society. Specifically, tell us more about the history of the society along with the main goals.
Okay, so the International Relations Society is the course union representing all students who are interested and who are enrolled in International Relations program at the University of Toronto. So in classes, we find that there is a lot of focus, or at least historically, on European-centric narrative of international relations. So what we try to do is we have academic seminars to move away from that. So we have themes on the Arctic, for example, on African development and on South America, the BRICS especially. And so what we do is we have an academic conference each year to complement that. We have academic seminars, but we also have a mentorship program that allows first and second year students to meet upper year students and recent graduates and see, get their experience about what the courses are like. The IR Society has been around for many years now. Just last year, we celebrated our 15th anniversary of the journal that we publish every year, and that's just an indicator about how long the IR Society has been around.
What strategies have you implemented in order to engage a wider range of students in the society's activities?
Okay, so that's quite a topical question because this year we're starting basically a rebranding process. So historically we noticed that there's a lot of Trinity students at the University of Toronto that come to all our events, and it's majority Trinity. So just for reference, there are 7 colleges at U of T. Trinity is the one where the International Relations program is hosted. But one of my visions that I did in my speech that I got elected was to focus on getting Victoria College students, University College students. So one way of doing that is that we've launched the trusteeship program this year. So we're getting basically college representatives. So one or two people from each college who represents international relations students there to come out, attend meetings, and to advocate on their behalf and to assist us in providing strategies so that we reach out to these different people.
What are some of the opportunities and challenges that you have experienced as a result of being the co-president of the International Relations Society up to this point?
So one of the challenges was just what I mentioned in terms of our Trinity-focused student body. And don't get me wrong, like, I am a Trinity student. Our entire exec is comprised of Trinity students.
Right.
But at the same time, that limits the scope of our audience and debate because we do come from a similar background. So that is a huge challenge. Another thing we had last year was consolidating our communications. So a few years ago, unfortunately, we had some issues with our listserv, with contacting students. We had a really old listserv with like 1,200 people on it, but unfortunately half of them had graduated. The email addresses weren't working, so I was vice president of communications last year, and we fixed that up, and we made it a lot better.
What advice can you provide to youth interested in becoming involved in international relations? Specifically, what advice would you give to elementary students and high school students who are interested in learning more about this this field?
So one thing for sure is to just follow the news, and don't just follow the news from a traditional like CBC background or just the CNN. Instead, look abroad to the BBC, the New Yorker, Deutsche Welle, for example. Try to get a more wholesome understanding of international relations from different perspectives and from the perspectives of different countries and their newscasts. So that's one way to do it. Another way is just to maybe talk to your parents about foreign policy, because I know when I grew up, my dad heavily influenced me, even though he's an accountant. He loves the news, and he would always tell me the news. Like, one thing I always berate him is that he never tells me bedtime stories, and instead he would just tell me the news. So that's how, that's a great way for the youth to get involved and get connected, and also to just start getting politically involved as well, even from a young age. And that doesn't necessarily joining a political party. I'm not politically affiliated, but just being aware of the opportunities to vote and to get involved in, let's say, your high school council, and advocating from that perspective.
What groups and or organizations would you suggest that students in elementary school
mm-hmm.
or high school should join?
Yeah, so one of the best groups that got me interested, especially, is Model United Nations. And I know a lot of high schools across Ontario and Canada are have Model UN groups. Another one is Debating. Many high schools have this, if not all, and that trains your ability to talk impromptu, ad hoc conversations, and that's a good way to get involved in debate in foreign policy, because some of the debates are squirrelable and you have the opportunity to talk about foreign policy.
Right. As an editor of the Canadian Political Science Student Association's journal, you review and you assist in the selection process of undergraduate academic essays. During this process, you edit and you also make suggestions pertaining to revisions for certain research papers, and you communicate with the editor-in-chief. What are some of the most pressing issues addressed in this journal up to this point that would definitely like stand out?
In terms of the content of the journals,
yes.
So this recently there was the call for papers on sovereignty and security. Last year they did one on energy and the environment. So it's very contemporary issues, and the theme of the journal falls actually on the conference theme of the Canadian Political Science Students Association. So that's how the themes of the journal are chosen. They also have general editions as well for all students to submit their papers. One of the advice in general I have for students who are submitting papers to academic journals is to make them readable, because when you submit papers to profs, many times that the edition of the journal is very technical,
mm-hmm.
and it's very not fun to read, because you have your introduction, you're outlining your thesis, you're outlining, for example, the historiography if you're doing a history paper, and it's just not fun to read for an editor, and that's how you get the editor's attention when they're looking for submission guidelines.
In terms of international relations and affairs, what would you say are the top three major issues and concerns happening in the world?
Okay, so for me, the major issue is the environment is a big one, because, like, the environmental issues will always be there, and the political will needs to match up with the environmental problems. So one of my favorite examples is to look at Germany and the political will that they exerted there to commit the country to go off of nuclear power by around 2030, 2050, they keep moving it. But as long as they have that political will there, so that is one of the main issues that is happening. Another one is more, it's not thematic, but it's more regional based, and I do quite a bit of work on Arctic issues, and I think that the Arctic is a new area of diplomacy, which I think should be paid more attention to, because it is a real model where diplomacy is working. And in the news, we often see issues about ISIS. We see issues about really depressing things, you know?
Right.
Migrants fleeing Syria. But when you look at the Arctic, you have this potential for conflict to erupt constantly because Russia is rearming. But at the same time, you have the Arctic Council, which is a consensus model of negotiation. And you really see some optimism there. So that is a major issue I think that countries should actually pay attention to, if not the 8 Arctic states. I would argue that China, which is not an Arctic state, is having more attention to the Arctic than Canada, which is an Arctic state. And I think contemporary right now, a major issue is the migration crisis that's happening in Europe and North Africa, and that's shaking the fundamentals of what we knew about international relations. Realism, state-to-state relationships is really changing. The Schengen visa and the whole Schengen regime in Europe may be gone in the next 20 years if something drastic doesn't occur to fix this. And these are the three issues, I think, which are happening now, but it has been a trend throughout, let's say, the past 30 years.
As a compliance analyst for the G7 and G20 research groups, you analyzed the European Union and Germany's trade commitments for the G7RG in 2014 and 2015. Please discuss your overall analysis and the examinations that were made.
Yeah, so for those positions, the trade commitments I was looking at was more environmental focused, and to see whether or not they complied with their environmental, the trading of, I believe it's called, I don't remember what it's called, but basically to see if this environmental regulations that they claimed at these summits is being enacted in policy. The European Union and Germany have done a lot in the past 10 years to commit its efforts to environment by, let's say, moving away from coal, divesting away from coal, and more into solar power and offshore wind. But I found that recently, because I guess the economic crisis, you see the whole migration issue, that they haven't focused about it as much. And you see, like, Merkel saying, like, we need to move away from nuclear, and then you see that they haven't done anything in the past year. So you're wondering what is happening with that.
Exactly.
So I compared this with the report I did the year before, and where they actually did a lot, but now they've forgotten it a little.
Mm-hmm. You also analyzed Turkey, the European
mm-hmm.
Union, and Germany's energy efficiency commitment for the G20RG in 2013 to 2014. Briefly discuss your observations and any additional examinations that you made during
yeah.
that report.
So for that report, it was actually quite positive for the European and Germany, as I just mentioned. They
right.
did enact a lot of investments in renewables. Turkey, not so much. I can probably accurately blame the Prime Minister for that. And I think that they have a lot of work to do in Turkey.
You were previously the president of the University of Toronto's Association of Political Science Students. Please discuss how that position is similar or dissimilar to the current position that you
mm-hmm.
hold as the co-president of the International Relations Society.
So it was a bit different in terms of I represented 2,000 students as the president of APSS, and now I represent about 400. So the resources I had access to as president of APSS were much more vast, and the faculty I could draw on was immense, and I had support of a very large department and a very large staff that could assist us in communications and reaching out to students, programming, funding, etc. In IR Society, it's very small. There's only two administrators. One is the director and one is the program administrator. The bulk of the constituents here are at Trinity. There is not a lot of funding that can be used for seminars and mentorship program from the program itself. So the challenges that we have here is stretching these resources thin enough that it covers enough people, but not to break this thin level of resources.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's different is that poli-sci is one discipline, and now we have three disciplines that are being represented, so economics, history, and poli-sci. And we have to work very carefully to make sure that each field is being represented proportionately, but also that none of them becomes underrepresented. Another thing about international relations is that we have a zillion regions to cover. That's a good thing about the Monk School here, is that they have a lot of centers and programs that assist us in our activities.
What have you learned as a result of your involvement with the University of Toronto's Association of Political Science Students?
So I think there's two things I have learned, one of which is transferable and one of which is not. The one that's not transferable is the amount of knowledge I have about the bureaucracies and the administrations at U of T.
Right.
And I've learned to basically which person to approach, when to approach them,
yeah.
when to send listservs out. So that's not transferable. So once I graduate here, I'm not sure what I can do with that knowledge. But the second thing I can do is that the people skills I've developed working there for the past 2 years as president and before that as vice president of communications, I really had to get to know these different people on campuses that I mentioned, but also to reach beyond that. And I think that really helped. I learned how to work in a team. I had a fantastic team last year. I don't think I can take any credit for my work for APSS without mentioning the team I had. And they were phenomenal, and I would be lucky for any president to have that kind of team again.
As a previous junior research fellow at the Atlantic Council of Canada, now renamed the NATO Association of Canada, what areas did your publications mainly focus on?
Yeah, so I wrote for the Global Horizons program, so the high school outreach. I wrote a publication on environmental security in Syria. So it was funny because I wrote this like a few years ago before the conflict really started to erupt in terms of migration. And the National Geographic just wrote an article very similar to that. So I was like, oh, this is cool. I wrote this a few years ago, and now they're publishing something on that. I wrote a piece on the Arctic about the Nordic Orion going through the Northwest Passage. I wrote on the history of NATO. Another article was about paradiplomacy. So Foreign Affairs came out with an article about the consulate or the relationship between Sao Paulo in Brazil and Toronto. And so I hypothesized the future of cities and international negotiations around the world.
What did you learn as a result of your affiliation with the NATO Association of Canada? As a previous program editor, as you mentioned, of the Global Horizons High School Outreach Program, what were some of the most rewarding opportunities you had as a result of informing students about global affairs?
Yeah, so your first half of your question, I definitely learned how to write better. So I did it in my second year, and I had this fantastic editor, which basically, as I was talking to you about, turning that academic form of writing into a more readable piece. So he taught me, like, when to break a paragraph in half, and I was like, okay, wow, in an academic paper, you just put this all together, but you have to make it more readable. So that was the first thing I learned in terms of, like, tangible skills. Another thing in terms of informing students about global affairs, I still do that now. I do a bunch of things on campus where I reach out to high school students and just tell them to study IR. Probably some of the more rewarding things I did in terms of that is like students who come from high school and they go to U of T to study international relations. And I don't want to think that I'm the reason to do that, but I'd like to believe that I'm a small part of that. And that makes me pretty happy because the program here is great. And I tell them to do the NATO Association internship because that's a great experience. You meet some phenomenal people. You get some tangible skills like the writing skills, and the events are really fun. So
absolutely. Any final words for the listeners?
Get involved with the NATO Association. Like, I did it in my first year. I went to a bunch of events. That's how I got to know Robert Baines, and he was great. I met some amazing people. Really started to develop the way I think.
Wonderful.
About security.
Great.
So.
Emily, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Emily, in 5 years from now, where do you see yourself?
To just finish law school and public policy and working on an articling position. And I think that's not a very inspiring thing for me to say, because that's still a lot of school. But in 10 years from now, I hope to be, maybe after working in law for a bit, to be going in public policy and to start enacting what I've been working on in university in terms of Arctic policy into action.
Great. Sounds like you have wonderful plans and goals for the future.
I just hope the Arctic doesn't melt that fast. So.
Thanks again.
Maybe you could be a mayor or a senator or a Supreme Court justice. You ready? But you might not know that until you join student government or the debate team. And no matter what you want to do with your life, I guarantee that you'll need an education degree. Let's go. What you make of your education will decide nothing less than the future of this country.